How to have your country and global trade too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday, January 17th. Thank you for joining us today. British Prime Minister Theresa May has been under pressure for months to reveal her plan for Brexit. In a speech today, she said the UK's exit from the EU would be a clean break, but would include the, quote, freest possible trade with European partners. From London, Stephen Beard has more.
There are two key components to the EU, the single market and the customs union. The single market guarantees the free movement of goods, services, capital and people throughout the member states. Today, Theresa May said she definitely wanted Britain out of this.
What I am proposing cannot mean membership of the single market.
She likes the free flow of goods, services and capital, but she says the majority of Brits clearly have a problem with the free movement of people.
The message from the public before and during the referendum campaign was clear. Brexit must mean control of the number of people who come to Britain from Europe.
Britain could pull out of the single market but stay in the EU's customs union, retaining unfettered access for its goods. And that's the way to go, says the opposition Labour Party's Keir Starmer.
Preserving our ability to trade successfully in Europe has to be the priority, and it is the priority for business. Then obviously staying in the customs union is the best way to achieve that.
But that would mean Britain wouldn't be able to go off and strike its own free trade deals. That's no good, May said today.
Now, I want Britain to be able to negotiate its own trade agreements, but I also want tariff-free trade with Europe.
She wants to have her cake and eat it too, grumbled a German politician. But in her speech, May warned against the rest of Europe trying to punish Britain for Brexit. That, she said, would cause Europe calamitous self-harm. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
More now on the flow of goods in and out of countries, the U.S. in this case. President-elect Donald Trump has said he wants a big border tax on imported goods. That would encourage corporations to set up factories in the U.S. and create jobs here. Republican leaders in Congress don't love that idea. They have come up with their own plan, calling it a border-adjusted tax. In an interview with the Wall Street Journal, Trump said the GOP plan is too complicated. So we asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer to do a little explaining.
First, let's look at how corporations are taxed now. Their tax bill is based on where the company is headquartered and where its products are made. Under the border-adjusted tax plan, companies would be taxed on where their products are sold. Basically, imports would be taxed, exports would not.
This is essentially a substitute for the corporate income tax now.
That's Michael Gratz, a top Treasury tax official in the George H.W. Bush administration, now at Columbia. Gratz says importers like Walmart, who buy stuff from China and sell it in the U.S., don't like the border-adjusted tax plan at all. The plan's supporters say other countries would need U.S. dollars to buy our stuff, so the value of the dollar would go up, making imports cheaper. Peter Cohn is an analyst with Height Analytics. He says retailers and other importers, like refiners who use imported oil, are lobbying furiously against the border-adjusted tax plan. They say consumers would end up paying more for imports.
Because all those goods you purchase at Walmart, the gasoline you purchase at the pump, could potentially have higher costs passed through to them as a result of the import tax.
So Cohn says the border-adjusted tax plan's days could be numbered, and this is just the beginning of the dance between Trump and congressional Republicans over what tax reform should look like. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Trump's nominee for Education Secretary, Betsy DeVos, is the latest cabinet pick to face her Senate confirmation hearing. DeVos is a billionaire whose family has given millions of dollars to support conservative Christian causes and Republican politicians. That includes five senators on the committee overseeing the confirmation process. She has no experience working in schools, but DeVos is a longtime education activist. From the Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
To her supporters, Betsy DeVos is a passionate advocate who believes everyone should have choices about where to send their kids to school. To detractors, her support for charter schools and vouchers makes her an enemy of traditional public education. But Matthew Chingos with the Urban Institute says the federal government only provides about 10% of K-12 education funding, and most big changes would require Congress to get involved.
So what the Secretary of Education can do on his or her own to affect public education in this country is pretty limited.
Aaron Pallas, a professor at Teachers College in New York, says DeVos is likely to push for expanded school choice with the support of a Republican-controlled Congress. During the campaign, Trump proposed a $20 billion grant program for states that would allow children living in poverty to attend the public, private, charter, or magnet school of their choice.
You can imagine a backpack on the back of a child stuffed with $100 bills that follows the child to whatever school he or she attends.
Jeannie Allen with the Center for Education Reform, which supports school choice, expects DeVos to promote innovation and reform by governors and school boards.
This is going to be an education secretary who wants local folks and states to help make their own decisions, and that's where the debate should be. We don't want it in Washington.
But it is Washington that will decide DeVos's fate. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the dollar drops and the pound soars. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Now, for the past year or more, we've been working on a series about the economy and the election, what one means and has meant for the other, and what both of them mean for the people behind the numbers and the headlines. It's called How the Deck is Stacked. It's our project with Frontline and PBS NewsHour. And this week, Kai is reporting from Erie County, Pennsylvania. Here's Kai now.
Here's what we were looking for to wrap up this series. A not-coastal city, not too big, not too small, built on what built this country, manufacturing. But now, trying to find its way in a changing economy. And one more thing. Obama then, Trump now. Because, and yes, there were a lot of things going on in that election, and the Trump margin here was kind of tight, just 2%. So his promises mattered. But Erie County is what a whole lot of November was about. Economic dissatisfaction, lost opportunities, and voters looking for something else. Until this year, GE Transportation was the biggest employer in Erie. They make motors for locomotives and tanks. The company has cut a third of its remaining workforce the past couple of years, jobs that paid $33 an hour with just a high school degree or less. But GE is only the current headline. Manufacturing losses have happened plenty here. Hammermill Paper, American Meter, Steris, and that is just a partial list, which gets us to a Thursday night 10 days ago. At the Polish Falcon Social Club, Nest 610. It's a neighborhood gathering spot. People stop by after work for a beer or two, dinner sometimes, and to just see people. There are things going on every night of the week here. Bingo, pool, and bowling, and it is packed on this cold and snowy January night.
Hi, I'm Buzz Andrzejewski. I'm a lifelong resident of Erie. My grandparents settled in Erie. I ended up in Erie through birth, and here I am.
Andrzejewski is 69. He's like a lot of people here, raised his family, and he put in his time.
I've had probably 15 different lives during my lifetime, so I have no complaints.
He's a lawyer now, but it took him a while. He started night school when he was 45, graduated more than 20 years ago.
Before that, I was a structural iron worker. Before that, I was a state senator. Before that, I was a boiler maker. Before that, I was an iron worker again. So like I said, You've been
around.
Yeah.
Buzz is a Democrat and a Clinton voter.
Well, of course, I wasn't in the majority in this county that voted for her.
Even though he didn't see the Trump win coming, Buzz's hindsight is 20/20.
He said the four-letter word everybody wanted to hear, jobs. Anyone who worked in a shop and lost their job, they were tired of that same old sound. Oh, well, we're going to have retraining programs for you. Well, if all your fingers are the size of your thumbs, it's hard to be a practical nurse for some guys. You know what I mean? It just don't work. And a guy wants what he had, all right? And what he had was a paycheck he could support his family. And now he's out there working two jobs wondering what's going to happen next. Tough.
You hear that a whole lot in Erie, and I heard it a whole lot among the Polish Falcons.
The hardest thing to find in Erie is a job.
We need a lot of jobs, good jobs, because GE was the only one left. I worked in shops all my life. If you're going into medicine, yeah, it might be a good place. As for manufacturing, it's dead.
That's a big problem around here, is factories closing or partially closing.
What changes are you expecting?
More industry, more jobs, manufacturing, definitely.
We're a manufacturing town. We need manufacturing. We need people to produce things.
That last voice is Joe Keeley. He's in the paint business. He sells industrial coatings.
When people are spending money, big money, capital money, and of course, a lot of the stuff that I sell kind of hinges on the price of oil and gas. So when we start producing more, do more fracking, start producing more gas, more oil, more equipment to do that is going to be made, and I'll be supplying coatings for some of that stuff.
It's been a little tricky lately, though, right?
Well, yeah, it's great if you're commuting, your price of gas, and
sure,
it's great for my heating bill, but for heavy fabricators and manufacturers, those people involved in that, steel and everything, they're seeing a slowdown.
Are you banking on it coming back? I mean, that is the promise that the president-elect has made.
Coming back into Erie? I'm not banking on it. I'm hopeful. I've never seen a president-elect so active. I mean, literally within hours after being elected. He's already influencing events. I personally can't stand the guy. But I think what he's up to, the people he's surrounding himself with, it gives me a lot of positive vibes that he's going to, somehow the job is going to get done. He's upsetting everything, which I think we need.
Erie today is not the place I grew up in.
Johnette Kent has lived in Erie her entire life. She is retired from the State Department of Public Welfare. She works at the Polish Falcons part-time.
When I was a kid in high school, any guy could walk out of school at 16, get a job at Hammermill, Cyrus Erie, GE, American Sterilizer, make a livable wage, and not need a high school diploma. My husband worked for American Sterilizer, Steris, for 37 years. He started when he was 17. They left for Mexico, and he was too young to retire. He had to find a new career. Since then, since Steris, he has never gotten a high-paying job. He was just downsized from another company this year, and now he's working 3 days a week, $8 an hour as a part chaser. That's sad, because he is a CNC operator, highly skilled machinist, and can't get a decent-paying job in this area.
Most of the decent-paying jobs here now are coming from the hospital and the big insurance company, industries that require skill sets different from the ones a lot of the lifelong residents of this city have. Erie City is reliably blue. Tomorrow, we're going to head out of town into Erie County, where the towns are smaller, the jobs are fewer, and the votes are redder. In the meanwhile, all the stories from our series, How the Deck is Stacked, live online at marketplace.org.
Coming up,
you know, Ray Kroc, businessman, maybe the first person that really understood the branding of a name.
Not his own name. We're actually talking about McDonald's. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 58 points, 0.3%, finishing at 19,826. The NASDAQ fell 35 points, 0.6%, to end at 5538. And the S&P 500 declined 6 points, that is 0.3%, to close at 2267. The dollar fell to its lowest level in a month after President-elect Donald Trump told the Wall Street Journal the dollar is, quote, too strong. The greenback declined more than 1% against the yen and other currencies. Now, according to Bloomberg, Qualcomm, the chip maker, will face an antitrust case for how the company licenses its technology. The company's shares dropped nearly 5% on that news. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.32%. And you are listening to Marketplace. Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. If you look around you at the cars and the planes and the buildings, a lot of them were designed using a piece of software called AutoCAD. It actually used to be the most used design software in the world. Things have slowed down a little for the company behind that software, Autodesk, but it's been looking for ways to expand what it does with the help of artificial intelligence and 3D printing. So I asked Carl Bass, the company's CEO, how much can 3D printing actually change your company?
It's definitely like all kinds of other technology in that it's been around for 25 years, but turned into an overnight sensation in the last few years.
Right.
But it got a lot of press around consumer uses of it.
Mm-hmm.
I've always kind of poo-pooed that and really thought the real use was in industrial uses. When you're 3D printing, it doesn't care how complicated the shape is. So my 3D printer will make the most complicated thing or a simple cube, and it's relatively indifferent to which one it's printing. And so, you know, it's like shape complexity comes for free with 3D printing.
See, that suggests that the potential application for your product could be really growing, right? Do you feel like you're on the cusp of a big potential expansion?
Oh, yeah. It's definitely growing in the kinds of products that people are making. So it was interesting. We're working with a German car maker. They've been making one part on their cars essentially the same for 20 years. And we were able to make a stronger part that's 30 to 40% lighter. Not only is it opening up new markets that were not possible before, even existing markets were able to go back and get better answers to problems that we already had.
Now, you mentioned skepticism about the consumer market.
It's
clear that 3D printing has kind of gone nowhere because it feels like 3D printing, even though you say it's a sensation, is still it's like virtual reality, right? It's a sensation that's just on the verge of arriving any minute now.
Yes. No, I think serious manufacturers are all evaluating 3D printing and have figured out the right place for it. It's not yet price competitive with, you know, the more traditional intensive manufacturing techniques. Mm-hmm. So in the places where you need something special, something custom, 3D printing is ideal for that.
So how big of a departure and or investment is that for Autodesk?
That has not been a huge investment. The place where we're really spending more money is on this idea of having the computer come up and suggest answers.
Yep.
Essentially, people, all of us, when we go to design something, we often go out and do it and we'll make one or we'll have three designs or we'll iterate and we'll get 5 or 10. And then we run out of time or money or patience and we say, good enough. The computer doesn't get bored in that same way. It doesn't run out of time. Mm. And so you can literally test millions of versions.
And what does that mean for the company? Is there job loss associated with that? Are you investing in proprietary technology? Are you partnered with Google? You know?
Yeah. So we're investing in proprietary technology. I mean, I think it's not job loss. I think this is a continuation of what we see kind of in the world at large.
Mm-hmm.
For people on one side of the digital divide who are building these kind of tools, this is fascinating work. It gets more interesting. We embed more expertise into it.
Right.
At the same time, it definitely, you know, contributes to job loss on the other side of the equation.
Is that something that the industry, I mean, does that keep you awake at night? How much does the tech industry need to take any responsibility for that?
You know, I think the tech industry needs to take real responsibility for it. You know, first of all, you know, it's like one of those, you know, 5-step programs. First thing is just to acknowledge it.
Yeah.
We are definitely taking expertise and putting it into software in a way that you can broadly distribute, you know, that digital information and have that expertise anywhere in the world. So I think there's a real and kind of special responsibility that the tech industry has about, you know, first acknowledging that it's contributing to it and then helping in ways that could potentially solve that.
Carl Bass is CEO of Autodesk. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Later this week, a new movie starring Michael Keaton opens in theaters nationwide. It's called The Founder, and it's about Ray Kroc and how he met the McDonald's brothers. Yep, that McDonald's. Kroc took their idea for a hyper-efficient restaurant and turned it into a global empire and took the whole company in the process. John Lee Hancock is the director. His other work includes the Oscar-winning movie The Blind Side. Hi, John.
Hi, Molly. How are you?
I'm great. I want to start by asking you what attracted you to this story.
I didn't know anything about the movie until the script landed on my desk. And I was kind of mesmerized by it because I found myself with a strong rooting interest for the protagonist, Ray Kroc, in the first half of the movie, and then started questioning some of his motives and actions in the second. And by the end, was kind of gasping at some of the things that he was doing. And I thought I hadn't read a script like that ever, and probably hadn't seen a movie like that in a long, long time. So I thought it seemed like a high-wire act that was worth trying to take on.
It's so interesting that the movie's called The Founder. I work out of Silicon Valley, and so much of that sort of concept resonates here, that it's not just vision, it's also execution. And it's interesting that this movie's called The Founder, even though that was sort of an assumed title.
Yeah, I believe it's probably intentionally misleading and goes to what your definition of founder is. And that's why the movie's kind of a Rorschach for people, I think. Everybody brings their own feelings into it and are hopefully affected by the movie. And that's why the reactions are conflicting sometimes. But I think that, you know, do you believe that the founder is the person who came up with the idea or the person who grew the idea?
And I read that the screenplay was written with insight from the descendants of the McDonald's brothers, those original founders. What was their take on how that deal turned out?
Well, the original rights to be able to do this movie came through the McDonald's brothers' family, Dick McDonald's family. And Don Hanfield contacted them and got, I think, Jason French, who was Dick McDonald's grandson, on the line. And he essentially said, we've been waiting 50 years for this call, you know, so our side of the story could be told, because it's been reported in books, the relationship with the McDonald's brothers, how strained it was. There are several instances of people bringing up the handshake agreement.
So the handshake agreement you're referring to when Ray Kroc takes over McDonald's from the brothers and says via handshake that he'll pay them royalties for the rest of their lives, right?
Yes, he had paid them a large sum of money in 1961 numbers. But in addition to that, they had requested 1% of future profits, and they never received their royalties, which would, I mean, the estimates go between $100 and $200 million a year per brother as to what they would have been worth. But the other thing is, it's funny, is it's like there were a lot more handshake agreements back there then, obviously. And Ray Kroc was famous for having lots of them, and lots of them worked out perfectly well. I think he had a handshake agreement with the guy who provided their paper products for like 40 years or something.
The movie opens on January 20th, which is Inauguration Day.
Yes.
Which, as it turns out, is a bit of remarkable timing, I think, because we're in this moment where business is ascendant in our country. How do you think people are going to feel about that?
It's really interesting because obviously when I first read it and when we made the movie, you know, Donald Trump wasn't a candidate yet or anything like that. That said, it is really interesting, you know, Ray Kroc, businessman, maybe the first person that really understood the branding of a name. And then you've got Donald Trump, businessman, really, really high on the branding of his own name. So it's, you know, yeah, there are interesting parallels.
That's John Lee Hancock, director of The Founder. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thanks, Molly. Thanks for having me on.
This final note before we go is also about movies. If you're tired of superhero sequels and Star Wars dominating the box office, well, get ready for an onslaught of musicals. Hollywood has lived in fear of the genre for decades, but think Frozen, Glee, The Wiz. Movie studios now have at least 20 musicals in the works. That's per the New York Times today. La La Land is also helping. Princess musical. It is an Oscar favorite, and it's taken in $132 million worldwide, even though it cost just $30 million to make. All right, we got to go. Kind of a tough day on Wall Street. The Dow dropped 58 points, 0.3%. The NASDAQ fell 35 points, 0.6%, to end at 55.38. And the S&P 500 declined 6 points. That is 0.3%. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kurwa, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I am Molly Wood, and we'll be back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.